Welcome to the fourth installment of Resisting Tyranny. The Imprimis magazine, which I recommend, is a free magazine you can get online. Just type in Imprimis magazine, it will take you to the website, and you can get it for free. It's a monthly magazine which they condense speeches and talks from experts from various fields in America. This is the April 2013 edition, Religion and Public Life in America, by R.R. Reynolds. He talks about three ways in which progressives in America today are choking religion and public life, pushing the idea, hey, you just can't stay in your little cubby corner of America anymore. You got to stay out of politics as best as you can. In 2005, the Hosanna Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church and school had a problem with one of its teachers. The teacher decided to take the problem to the courts, which is contrary to biblical law, to Lutheran law, to Presbyterian law, and all of the churches that take the Bible seriously. And the teacher is a member of that body, and so she was disciplined for doing such. She wasn't satisfied with that and apparently went to court. The Obama administration, in trying to defend that decision and go after that Lutheran church and school for what they did to the teacher on religious grounds, in which she's part of, and she covenanted to and bowed in submission by signing that document. They argued that there should be not be ministerial exceptions in this case, that they should be under discrimination laws like any other company. Now, they lost in the Supreme Court. They just flat out lost. There wasn't a single minority decision in their favor. Every judge said that's crazy because this is a religious school and she is, for practical purposes of the law, a religious teacher. But who's to say that the Supreme Court won't change in 40 years or 30 years or 20 years and we get to the next point because of that, like Obamacare. That is the administration, the lawyers that are already thinking that way, and these lawyers just have to get into the right position and have enough people to think like them and get them into the courts. And they could become judges and they rule against Christians and go after ministerial exceptions, perhaps, and other things like that. So the fact that they thought they can get away with it and there are lawyers that think this way does not bode well for America. So Obamacare, as you know, is an issue right now through the courts with Hobby Lobby and others because they're trying to argue, we don't care if it's religion, you're not technically part of the church, so there's still part of the secular laws you must follow. We don't care if you own your company, religion should be subservient to the government. Now, as an aside, I'm recording this now that Obamacare is dismantled and Trump is president, but he won't be president forever, and providentially, likely, I speak as a man, after him there won't be another one like him who will slow down what is happening. So these issues are still relevant today. And then to continue on with the Imprimis article, and then Judge Walker, as you recall, I mentioned that earlier in the class the first day when I went through the litany of things suggesting and pointing to increasing legal harassment. That's the word I'll use. I don't want to use persecution. We don't know persecution in America the way they do in the Middle East and elsewhere. Legal harassment, even truncating our rights as they did New Mexico Supreme Court against the Christians in a photography business down there. Then there was, in this case, a very helpful illustration issue of Bob Jones in the early 80s. They went to the Supreme Court because they had a law. Their own ruling in their own school, it's a private school, was you can't have interracial dating and marriage. In this case, it would be dating. They still had that in the early 80s, I think, of course, but the government thought it was so terrible and went to the Supreme Court, and Bob Jones lost. Think about the implications of that. They said, you're an institution, not a church per se, so they are circumventing and making small the idea of religious freedom to just being the church, although we Christians believe the kingdom of God is wherever the Christians live and rule and do their business and the like. So they're circumventing religious freedom to the narrow institution of public church, which apparently is just on Sundays or whenever a pastor speaks, but not you Christians. That's the rationale used. The paper goes on, explains how one lawyer argued, didn't argue, but gave a conclusion. I'm hard-pressed to find arguments wherever gay rights and marriage clash with religious rights. Who should win the term of religious or gay rights? The person said, quote, I have a hard time giving the religious right the winner. I think that gay rights should win. I can't find a good argument to defend religious liberty against gay liberty, end quote. That's how some of the legal lawyers are thinking right now. The professors are thinking right now. You have to be aware, brothers and sisters. This is a real issue, and it's happening in our time, and it hasn't come to a head yet, but it may. And so I think and pray, and I believe this class can therefore be helpful if we just start thinking in these terms and start instructing other Christians of their own tradition of resistance to governments and tyranny and the limits of obedience to said government. We're going to go over the tradition in this regard of the question of the limits of government. As you recall, I'm not covering everything in terms of limits of government, just specifically how far, to what extent we should submit, and then when and where do we draw the line of resistance, and not just passive resistance, but active resistance to the government, even just war, even to the point of resisting tyranny. You know, what is tyranny like? So I want to cover today a short history, Christian history. It's not an exhaustive history. I'm not an expert on this. It's something I've studied the last semester and over the years on the side on my own. I'll start with the Old Testament and the history of just war, resistance, and how Christians have been involved. In the next few weeks after this, I'll cover submission and how the Bible is very clear about submission and how we're called to submit and how we can go a lot further even than we think we've done at times, right, even up to scenarios in which for you to think about. Should I resist or should I be wise as a serpent and gentle as a dove and determine where to stand my ground and elsewhere? These are serious questions to ask. Then, after that, we'll go over how the reformers from Calvin on into the 1600s up to John Milton and some of the Covenanters, how they argued and defended just war, resistance to tyrants, and so you can see the rationale and reasoning from the Bible, from natural revelation, and from the logic upon these grounds. And we'll also go over the text and go more into detail exegetical reasonings for this position. Now today we have the Old Testament. We're going to cover up to the New Testament, Middle Ages, which we call the pre-Reformation, the Reformation period up to the modern. Now in the Old Testament has examples of believers fighting in wars. Anybody remember any? Of course you do. You could say Israel. Time before Israel, that's right, Abraham. Remember him? That's right, Abraham. He fights the five cities. He rescues Lot. He made a pact with them even though they were unbelievers. Now, of course, Israel comes along, God forms Israel out of Egypt, properly speaking. The origin of freedom in this case, not only spiritual freedom, but political freedom. They have offensive battles where God says, go into Canaan and wipe out the enemy. That's given by God's positive command. As you recall, positive command is that of a special commandment in the Bible given for particular purposes, like when you tell your children to go to bed at 7 o'clock at night. There's nothing in the Bible that says, children, go to bed at 7 at night. It just says, children, obey your parents. And so it's a broad command that allows all kinds of individual applications up to the parents. They make these particular laws, or positive laws in this case. It's not binding forever, only in the unique circumstances of a 7-year-old or childhood. We don't expect this of a 15-year-old. That would be oppressive of a parent to do that, although a child should still submit in that case. There are worse oppressions, of course, than having to go to bed at 7 o'clock at night. Now, that's a positive law, and God gives a number of positive laws and commands in the Bible that are no longer binding. They are unique. We're not called to be prophets or run around eating food off the heat of dung, right? Or taking off most of our clothes and walking around bemoaning the fall of Jerusalem. You know, all those incredible stories to make graphic illustration what God tells them to do, because God is talking to the Old Testament church. If God would talk to us today, we would have to obey. And the only way he talks, however, is through the Bible. So, the history of just war, self-defense, and resistance to tyrants starts all the way back at the beginning of time, almost and certainly the time of Abraham. It's divine history that we know of in the Bible, and defensive battles of Israel, of course, and lots of those wars, whether you want to call them defensive or offensive, certainly had a lot of religious overtones and had a lot of issues of adultery and the like. Now, before the New Testament time period, we have the Maccabean revolt, in which the Jews got together and tried to overthrow Rome and Israel, and they succeeded for a short period of time. You can't succeed, humanly speaking, against Rome very long, and they didn't. So that's the intertestamental period in which the Jews believed, even without having access to all their land rights, that they don't have to have, and they didn't have a kingdom anymore. They still believed they had the divine right to resist when tyranny fell upon them, especially because of the desecration of the temple. Now, during the time of Christ, New Testament period, we don't have a lot of details of their views. We have a lot of New Testament that tells us how to think differently than how the Jews thought, or more precisely, to think more fully than what some of the Jews thought, such as the Pharisees. We know in the New Testament, it's a continuation of the Old, but also an expansion of the Old, greater illumination of the Old. It's not a special point for them to emphasize the idea of just war, of course, resistance to tyrants, any more than it's a special point of the New Testament to point out some particular laws that we believe are wrong and wicked that are otherwise there by implication. Now, what's interesting We'll go over these texts later, of course, is that Luke 22:36, for instance, Christ tells his disciples, "Let him who has no sword sell his mantle and buy one." He's not saying fight. He's saying be prepared to have a fight, apparently. I want you to buy a sword. Maybe he's thinking self-defense with respect to bandits on the road and the like we have in the story of the Good Samaritan. That's probably at a minimal what he's thinking. So he's saying, take prudent measures. Don't be presumptuous and think the Holy Spirit is going to divinely protect you from a sword thrust. That has implications, doesn't it? And how to answer this question of resistance to tyrants and just wars and the like. At the same time, Christ said, submit, turn the other cheek in Matthew 5. How do you reconcile those two? We'll talk about that a little bit later, but I want to point out that it's here in the Bible. It's talked about to one degree or another, of course, to a greater degree in the Old Testament and in practice, of course, this whole issue. Peter and Paul in 1 Peter and Romans 13 give more details. It says very clearly we're supposed to submit to government powers, and the question is, what does that mean? To what extent should one submit, even to the point of him stealing your wife? You start thinking extreme cases, and I think even some Christian pastors will start realizing, well, maybe not that far. I guess we can do some resistance, maybe flee perhaps. Even Christ himself says, when it gets really bad, flee. Flee Jerusalem. Again, don't be presumptuous and think the Holy Spirit's going to protect you divinely from a sword thrust. Now, in the pre-Reformation era, we have at one time where thousands were massacred by armies. Theodosius, the king, wanted to go into the church after using the armies in the 300s, I believe, as I recall, slaughtering thousands and massacring them. However, St. Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, forbade him to set foot into the church, requiring of him full confession and penitence for his crimes. Even the king, he said, must, when it's terrible enough, be punished by the church. And again, that's related to the questions of jurisdictions and therefore of resistance. This is a form of not resistance, but an act of moral implication, a rule over the king, saying, you claim to be a Christian, you want to come into the church, you're going to be disciplined by the church. Caesar cannot be claiming to be over God in these moral categories. Now, properly speaking, the doctrine of just war was more or less systematically explained by Augustine. It's not fully fleshed out until the time of Aquinas in official form, and after that, more details and logical rigor is further embedded in Christian tradition, especially in the Calvinist branch or the Reformed branch, as it's sometimes called. We have Augustine around the 400s, and I have a section here by Thomas Aquinas in his book explaining Augustine and quoting him. Now, Augustine, of course, believes in terms of just war, and he actually asserted this. He said that you can only have a just war if you have just or proper authority. Not just anybody can go to war. It has to be for a just cause or a righteous cause or a proper cause, not for petty reasons or reasons of revenge. So the heart is important. And then you have the right intention. I just bled into that idea, of course, the just cause or right intention. A passion for inflicting harm and cruel thirst for vengeance, an unrelentless spirit and the like, the fervor of revolt, the lust of power and such things are all rightly condemned in just war theory. Now, think about that. You have a Christian leader, Augustine, saying, if we're going to have war, we have to have it in a Christian manner. There has to be limits to war. You can't just go off and fight whenever you feel like it and do whatever you feel like doing in the name of war. Which sounds very strange. This sounds very strange to some people's ears when they misunderstand Christianity about what it is and what it involves. They may say, well, that's crazy. How can you talk about killing somebody? How can you talk about war and then doing it in a very civilized manner? Hello, sir. Are you having a nice day? Stab. They want to mischaracterize it that way. And again, we'll cover more of this later. I want you to know that the belief that there is a just war and proper reason to go to that war were systematized as far back as Augustine in the 400s. Another quote from Augustine here in one of his letters here that Aquinas quotes, quote, if the Christian religion forbade war altogether, those who sought solitary advice in the gospel would rather have been counseled to cast aside their arms and give up soldiering altogether. On the contrary, there we are told, remember this is in Luke 3:14, and do violence to no man and be content with your pay. He commanded them to be content with the pay, he did not forbid soldiering. This is the centurion, as you recall, not quoting Augustine anymore, coming to Jesus and saying, what shall I do? And Jesus had to say, throw it all down, give it up. Why are you in the army? That's crazy. You're preparing to kill people? You actually killed people? You probably did kill people? No, Jesus said nothing of the kind. Don't unnecessarily harm other men and be content with your pay. He said nothing like throw down your arms, like liberals today would say. Get out of that wicked army. This in itself is significant, and that argument has already been made by men who are paying attention to the whole counsel of God. He also says in another letter, we do not seek peace in order to be at war, but we go to war that we may have peace. Be peaceful, therefore, in warring, so that you may vanquish those whom you war against and bring them to the prosperity of peace. End quote. The point of war isn't to annihilate them, but to bring an end to hostility, so that they will be convinced finally through rational thought instead of violence. Let's stop fighting. Let's get this over with. Now that's a significance, and that's important in terms of why one goes to war. Now 700 years later, we have in 1215 AD the Magna Carta, the large chart, that's what it is from the Latin, where they grab King John, who the barons and leaders of England were tired of, and the things that he did, saying, we're going to make you submit to a covenant, a national covenant, the Magna Carta. We're going to write down some of our rights and the things that you can do and you can't do, and we get to do so we can live in peace, and you're still our king. However, Clause 61 of the Magna Carta says very clearly, if it gets bad enough and the king is not going to do what he's supposed to do, this is obviously not their wording but mine, you can have a meeting of the barons and overrule the king if need be through force by taking over the castle and other like things. So again, it's part and parcel of Christian history and Christian teaching and Christian practice. These beliefs and doctrines and the systematizing of them finally comes to full fruition during the Reformers' time. At that time, that's the same period of time of the Magna Carta overall, a couple hundred years later, you have Thomas Aquinas, one of the great early medieval Christian thinkers, systematic thinkers, late medieval. He too defends just war and even resists the tyrants, arguing in his Summary of Theology that it is good and it's the proper thing to do. And he goes to some same verses as Augustine, and defends it. So it predates, again, the Reformers. Now here we have in 1548, Charles V issued during the Reformation his famous Augsburn Interim, which declared all the lands of the Holy Roman Empire shall follow the Council of Trent, be Catholic, and act like a Catholic. So this is several decades after the Reformation is going on, is still promulgating back and forth and all the stress and wars and difficulties. It was an attempt to smash the Protestant Reformation. While all of Protestant Germany conformed to the decree, one city decided to take a stand and resist his authority. That city, called Magdeburg. The pastors of the city issued their confession, a defense of the pastors and the ministers of the Church of Magdeburg. On April 13, 1550 A.D., 5 months after issuing the confession, Charles V marched on Magdeburg. The people of Magdeburg burned everything outside the city walls and closed the city gates, and the siege had begun. It lasted about a year and ended in a stalemate. But at the end of the day, by the early 1600s, they finally had the freedom they were seeking. Charles V could not enforce such a rule among some of the cities, in this case, this particular city. And they wrote a confession. You can find it online now, I believe. I have the book. I didn't read the Latin. This is a translation. It gives rationales, and it's from a Lutheran perspective. And at that time, it was one such perspective that encouraged Beza, the protege of Calvin of Geneva, to write up a defense from this perspective. Now, you also have other events going on during the tumultuous 1500s. It wasn't just Luther. There were all these other places and countries, Zwingli and Geneva and parts of Germany and Holland, saying, hey, we're Protestant. We don't have to be Roman Catholic. We don't have to follow the rules. You recall the Roman Catholics were very, very closely wedded to the politics of the day and the king and the rulership thereof, in a way the Reformers certainly were uncomfortable with and disagree in the doctrines of their theory of the sword, the two-sword theory, while the Dutch wished to be liberated from Spain. In the 1500s, yes, some of the Dutchmen would know that. Spain was Roman Catholic. No, enough of this, they were saying. We're tired of you ruling over us and telling us to be Roman Catholic. We're going to fight you. And they did. And they gave some of the reasons, and they cast it off. And it was a long war, as I recall. I don't know, again, I'm not an expert in history, and I didn't go into all the details. But they, too, believed in just war and practiced it and gave rationales for it. And you have the French Wars, the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, that some of you may recall, when they went to France on the same night and slaughtered thousands upon thousands and reports of tens of thousands of Protestants in one night. Across the country, Reformed Christians in particular, the Huguenots they were called, slaughtered by the Frenchmen and the French leadership. They had a war for many years there as well, and they also had lost. The France has always stayed Roman Catholic, and the Huguenots were always persecuted, and they fled by the millions over the next 100 years. Here we have in the 1560, however, in Scotland as well, where John Knox is resisting what he believes to be religious tyranny as well. They had put together a confession. In chapter 14, the Scots Confession of 1560, we read, "What works are reputed good before God? We confess and acknowledge that God has given to man his holy law, in which not only are forbidden all such works as displease and offend his godly majesty, but also are commanded all such as to please him, and as he has promised to reward. And these works are of two sorts. The one are done in the honor of God, the other to the profit of our neighbors, and both have the revealed will of God for their assurance. To have one God, to worship and honor him, to call upon him in our troubles, to reverence his holy name, to hear his word, to believe the same, to communicate with his holy sacraments are the works of the first table. To honor father, mother, prince, rulers, and superior powers, to love them, support them, yea, to obey their charges, not repugning to the commandments of God, to save the lives of innocents, to repress tyranny, to defend the oppressed, to keep our bodies clean and holy, to live in sobriety and temperance." That was in the Scots Confession of 1560. Part of what they believe in the second table of the law was to save lives of innocents, to repress tyranny, and defend the oppressed, right in the confession there. Because religion had nothing to do with politics, right? Of course it did. It informed the ethics of politics. It doesn't today, because a lot of Christians in America, or at least religious people, have been taught so long that they believe, it seems, this false lie of separation of religious or morality from politics. But religion affects politics because religion, specifically Christianity, says God is in charge of all things, and that includes politics, and God has something to say about it. It's a moral law that's required of us when we're involved in politics, as opposed to a legal positivism, which we have in America mostly, which says we can make whatever law we have, and that makes it moral. Whoever's in charge makes the rules. Now, skipping ahead to the 1600s, you have the larger Catechism Confession, 135 and 136, that is, questions 135 and 136. Question 135 of the larger Catechism says, quote, "By just defense thereof against violence," end quote. It's therefore under the Sixth Commandment. It's part, again, of the Reformed tradition, in our case, the Puritans and the Presbyterians. And we'll cover some of this later in the rationale they use and the proof text they have. But it's built into our system of confession and is there a time and a place for self-defense. I said I believe the Bible, I believe the confession is a summary of the Bible, and so I have to teach this. I have to believe, and I have to encourage you guys to believe it as well. It's my duty as your pastor. I can't always do that, and that's fine. It's part of our tradition, nevertheless, and we've acted upon it both in Scotland and Holland and in France. And they had their battles over in the East as well. I'm not an expert in all this, that is in Hungary and Transylvania. They have Reformed churches there that also resisted tyranny. Now, I went over the last few days, as you recall, the proper use of the law of God, and if you didn't fully see it, I'll make it clearer now. It's not so easy and clear that you have just these rules, 1, 2, 3, and you're done. It's circumstantial. Where is it? How serious is the oppression? Is there a way to avoid bloodshed? And when you see here, when I go through some of this, the history of the Reformed thinkers, some of the writers will make it very clear. Do what you can to avoid war. Just because there's a tyrant, in other words, doesn't mean, hey, let's get him. It's not a blank check. And he's not saying that they believe there is a blank check. They never did. But it has to be carefully considered and weighed before you resist. It's the circumstances. What's the cause? Why are we being persecuted? What type of persecution? What other options are there short of war? That's a very serious thing. Killing people, potentially losing your own life and the life of your family. I'll give you one option if you're thinking of the Syrian war. It takes, as I recall, millions, and I thought it was going to be a lot more than that, millions and millions of dollars to move an aircraft carrier. Just move it. Support it. Move it. Couldn't you take that money and leave the boat sitting back at the dock and say, hey, well, if you can get across the border, we'll give you $10,000 a family and you go to Europe, go elsewhere in the Middle East. You don't think it's a lot of money for a Middle Eastern family? You don't think there's another way to avoid war? How much money does it cost to get an aircraft carrier there, get the bombs and drop them, as opposed to thinking of another alternative way to help the people if we're really concerned about them? It's not like there's no other options. There's another option. It's often the case. We're going to fight them because it's easy, because we have the technology. Is that a reason to go to war? We have to think that way. Because we're Americans? No. No, the reformers, however, took war seriously. In other words, war is the last thing you want to do, and I believe that with all my heart. It's the last thing you want to do unless you're forced into a corner. And unfortunately, in international politics, we like to think we're in corners all the time. People may disagree with me, but I think it's quite obvious. What are the religious and moral rights to stand up to tyrants? Who is a tyrant? Should we even stand up to them? There were, I recall reading one time, hundreds of pamphlets defending the resistance against the kings in the mid-1600s and the Civil War in England, and Milton was one of them. Remember John Milton? What did he write? Yeah, that's right. Paradise Lost, Paradise Regained. And he was a Puritan in many ways. He wasn't established per se, although he's a Congregationalist, and he wrote a number of things, and he wrote wonderful poetry. But he also wrote a tract against the tyranny of kings, and a lot of those reformers, the Puritans at that time, were like polymaths. They dabbled in all kinds of subjects and dealt with them and drilled down into them exegetically as they could. What you have then in Latin and is two things here summarized in this whole little section here of history in a more systematic fashion. You have jus ad bellum and then just in bello. Yeah, you're what? Ad and in bellum and bello. That's the Latin. I have it in the handouts. The first one that is jus ad bellum. The first one is justification for the hostility, and the second one is the idea of justice in the hostility, having a civilized war. There's a just cause to go to war, and when you have such a war, you must be civilized. There must be justice, jus in bello, in the war itself. Not heinous crimes, but just enough to fight, to win, and stop the battle. The reason for the war, once you go into war, is how you operate in the war, and finally how you finish the war. This is part of our tradition. It's part of the Western legal tradition, which has a lot of religious roots to it, as I've shown. Religious in the sense that people thought it was related to morality and belief in the Bible and God. Not necessarily religious in the sense that they can go to the Bible and find chapter and verse for every law. That's a careful distinction here for anybody who happens to be listening to this. All those crazy Christians who want to make a theocracy. No. We believe in natural law, but we don't believe natural law contradicts the Bible. It is part of our tradition. That is natural law, and a tradition many people don't know about. See, here are some of the questions to ask if the war is just. Is it a just cause? Is there competent authority? Is there reasonable expectation of success? Doesn't Christ tell you they're supposed to count the cost, not just go blindly into something? And finally, have all other means of peace been sought? Do not target. Don't go after civilians. So that's jus ad bellum, justification for hostility. I have butchered the Latin, I'm sure. Now, justice in the hostility, jus in bello. Do not target civilians. And we can take that kind of for granted today, at least in Christian circles. Use proportional and minimal force. They hit you with tanks, don't hit them with a nuke. They come after you with a gun, don't hit them with missiles. I'm serious, that's the Christian response. You're just going to do enough to stop the hostility, not perpetuate it, and get them all upset so they come after you again, and this time with a nuke. I mean, that's foolish. Benefits must outweigh the evils and cease when objectives are accomplished and resume normal relations. That's the goal. Finally, have a peace accord and go back to normalcy as you are able. It's never been the Christian goal, and it's against the Christian goal and the Christian belief, just to wipe out the enemy for the sake of wiping them out. There must be a reason to go that far, to shut them down, to maintain peace, and to finish the battle. In other words, you have a war. You try to minimize it as much as you can. Keep it as short as possible, because war is a terrible thing. People die. You can't stop killing civilians, of course. You want to minimize that by having as quick a war as possible. But it is going to happen. You shouldn't do it intentionally, but there's chaos in country when there's war, and civilians are going to be hurt. Civilians don't know where to go sometimes. You know, you see the nice, pretty red lines on the map and say, oh, look, there's the enemy. You can see it and avoid it. No, that's not how war is. War is messy, even today with the best of our technology. And you can end up behind enemy lines and get killed. War is a terrible thing. Even during the Revolutionary War, they thought it was a right, just cause. They still cried out to God for mercy. They had days of fasting and prayer by the Continental Congress, because although they believed in the just cause, but it was through terrible means, even as their own people were dying. The two are not contradictory. Just because it's terrible and the effects of it doesn't mean the cause isn't good. It doesn't mean that what you're doing is not right. When you discipline your children, it gets so bad, you might kick them out of the house. It's just and proper, although the consequences are bad. I don't want them living in the street. Yeah, that's true, but it doesn't undermine the justness of your cause. They believed, in fact, a number of the writers I have read believe that war itself was a punishment. It's a necessary punishment in some case, that is, if it's a just war. You've just got to do it nevertheless for a greater cause. You've got to suffer the affliction because you're still trying to go for the proper goal, which is to stop hostility, retain your life, and your liberties. Now, that finishes this day. Let's go ahead and pray.